Good afternoon. So, let me see why my mic volume seems quiet. That would be why my mic volume seems quiet. Okay. Good afternoon, this time with amplification. So, last time, we talked about going beyond just system calls. We realized there were some other cases where it's really useful to have the OS run, basically because we have our hardware not know what to do to handle a bunch of different situations. And so our solution to that is we said, well, the system call idea is a way of kind of running the OS in a controlled manner. We can reuse that idea, that same way of starting the OS, switching to kernel mode, but we can use it for other types of events. We'll have the same idea that the OS, when we boot the machine, is going to register in some place the hardware understands, functions to run for particular events, but those events aren't just going to be a program request, a system call, it's going to be various things the hardware can't do on its own. And we talked about several examples of that. So one was that when programs sort of access memory they weren't supposed to, do things that usually cause a crash. Well, usually what's happening underneath is that the hardware tries writing the program, it realizes, I don't know how to handle this thing the program's trying to do, like accessing this memory that I looked at your mapping OS, it doesn't say anything there, or dividing by zero. The hardware doesn't know how to handle that situation, so it runs this OS register routine to do it. We also talked about it being used to keep programs from sort of running out of control. So if you write an infinite loop, there's no reason to run the OS in that code for the infinite loop. But what will happen is that the OS will run anyways. And how will that happen? Is we'll have some timer the OS gets to set up to ensure that the program it's about to switch to doesn't get to run forever. That, no matter what, when that timer expires, the OS gets to run, and if it wants to, it can switch away from that program. We also mentioned that this is going to be used for input and output. And this is sometimes a point of confusion because the reason we have a new type of exceptions, something that's not just system calls for input and output, is because sometimes the hardware that implements that input and output, like a keyboard or a hard drive and so on, needs the attention of the OS to handle the situation. So in case of a keyboard, when I press a key, the OS needs to get that key press, retrieve it from the keyboard, and needs to send it to whatever program's interested in it. And that case of the hardware needing attention, that's going to be an exception that runs the OS to deal with that scenario. And separately from this, programs might want the OS to, when it decides how to handle that hardware's request or data, the OS program might request, hey, that next key press, get it to me. And that operation, the program asking the OS to do something in particular with the key press, that's a system call. But that doesn't actually communicate with the hardware necessarily. When the hardware needs to get the OS to run when it normally wouldn't, it uses an exception to do that. But when we're doing input and output in our programs, typically there will be, I guess not typically, but often, there will be a combination of system calls where we tell the OS, hey, these are the things I'd like you to do with the hardware, and hardware device triggered exceptions, where the device says, hey, that thing you asked me to do earlier, you need to finish it. That sort of thing will happen. So there'll be a combination of two different types of exceptions to handle those cases. So when I talked about this timer triggered exception to move away from a program, this gets us to switching between different programs. And when we started this class, we previewed this idea of what I call time multiplexing, that we're gonna have one processor, but we're gonna share it, and we're gonna share it by dividing up time on that processor. And to implement that, we need a way of stopping one program and running another, but being able to go back to the original program. And our implementation of that, we're going to call a context switch. And what we're going to do is we're going to save the program's state, and we said the thread state. So we're going to save all the stuff that's currently active on the processor for later. Then sometime later, we'll take that stuff that used to be on the processor and put it back there. We call that stuff we save the context of the thread. The thread is kind of our virtual processor, and sometimes our virtual processor actually gets to use the real processor. Other times, we've just saved its state, its context, somewhere in the OS's memory to use later. And that context, sort of most importantly, includes all the registers and the program counter and the address space information. So the operation of a context switch is we're saving one thread state and restoring another. And this is something the OS can just do when it wants to. Now, typically, the OS runs from an exception. So what will happen is an exception will be triggered, and sometime in the process of handling that, the OS will say, oh, this is a good time to do a context switch, and do it. And that could mean all sorts of exceptions could trigger a context switch, because it's just up to what does the handler code do. If the OS wrote handler code to switch to another program, that will happen. So questions on sort of exceptions and context switches. Okay, so let's talk about signals. So signals are kind of like exceptions for processes. That's sort of the model we gave, is that, you know, exceptions are something the hardware gives the OS, and signals are something the OS gives processes, normal user programs. But they provide the same kind of functionality that we let you handle signals, and that means we run a function of your choice when an event that triggers a signal happens. It's just like the hardware runs a function of the OS's choice when an event that triggers an exception happens. And one big use of signals is to forward things the hardware tells us about as an OS to the program. So the OS will notice something happened in the hardware. So the example we started with was pressing Control C. And the OS handles that by kind of forwarding it to a program that's registered a handler for that event. So it turns the hardware exception into a signal handler call. How does it do that? Its handler for the hardware exception looks up and says, oh, there's a handler registered for this in the process. Why don't I call that and let that run and see what happens? And in the case where there's no handler, which is probably the situation you're most familiar with if you press Control C a lot, is that, you know, the default action the OS takes is terminating the process. And that's true for a lot of these signal events. And we're going to talk a bit more about signals, but questions about kind of our basic idea of what signals are, how the signal handler runs. Okay. So last time we looked at sort of this big list of, you know, a subset of the Unix signal types. And so we had these signals we can potentially handle for sort of invalid memory accesses, Control C. We have this floating point exception for like divide by zero and other math errors, which non-intuitively includes integer divide by zero, I'm guessing because division used to be done sometimes on FPUs on some weird systems, but that's the history. We had this notion of, oh, we'll use this signal to handle the idea of what if I'm SSH into a machine and my session disconnects. How do I inform the programs about that? We'll use a signal to do that. That's the decision Unix has made. And we also have these two special signals that you can't actually handle yourself. That's just a way of letting you, by invoking the system call that explicitly sends a signal to a program to either make a program terminate no matter what, or make a program pause no matter what. So something you might wonder is, okay, SIGSEC fault, probably the most, maybe the first or second most familiar signal of this list to people here. It's a signal, so we can register a handler for it. And I showed you when we registered a handler for SIGINT, for control C, that kind of made the control C kind of do nothing. Our handler like printed a message and went on, and the program just continued. So what happens if we do the same thing for SIGSECV? Are we gonna get our program just continuing? So let's try that. So here, I have a program that does that. I have this function called handle SIGSECV that I've made, and in order to make that be a signal handler for SIGSECV, I need to run SIGACTION. So I set up this SIGACTION struct that has my information about the signal. I set the most important field of the SIGACTION struct to say the handler I want you to run, in this case, is handle SIGSECV. I set this signal mask, and we'll talk later about what signal masks are, but it turns out that there's going to be this notion we'll talk about of temporarily pausing certain signals, but we're not going to pause any signals. We're just going to let everything happen normally. And I will set a flag of these flags, and I'm going to set it to say restart. This doesn't actually say to restart or not. This says that if we're in the middle of a system call, please try to keep that system call going. That's all this says. So actually, it doesn't really do anything in this case. We have the same result if this was zero, because I'm not making any system calls after SIGACTION. But if I were, this would say, that system call that you were stopping, look, try to keep restart it. So like if we were trying to read from the keyboard, and the signal handler happened, then go back to that read instead of, making that read fail. So we set our settings and we register our signal handler. I'm saying that it's for the SIGSEC fault signal. I specify, my information. So I give a pointer to the struct to specify all that information. I have this third null argument that in the code I've written is always null. Its purpose is that it tells you the old settings for the signal handler if you want to retrieve them. They will be put in the pointer you pass in if you pass in a non-null pointer. Generally, I don't think that's very useful, and probably you'll just always pass them. So I do all that, and now we have a signal handler for the SIG fault signal. And then to experiment with this, I have my assembly instruction here that moves from RAX into memory location 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in hex, which probably isn't a valid memory location. And we'd expect, if I didn't have this signal handler stuff, to make my program just crash and the shell would print segmentation fault to my console. But we've set up a handler, so that shouldn't happen. And indeed, it won't happen. And, we'll get output. And that's not a typo there. We'll get got SIGSEC fault lots of times. Not just once. So what's happening? So this instruction here, it triggers the hardware exception, and that runs the OS handler. The OS handler is going to save sort of the PC and registers and call handle sig-segv. Okay, that happens. And that explains how we got here, right? Our handler runs, and then our handler returns. And when our handler returns, the OS restores the saved, the PC and the registers from before the signal happened. So our program kind of jumps up here, it returns, and then it goes back. And it happens that the program counter that's saved is the one of the instruction where we had a seg fault. That's where we're going to go back to. So we go back to that instruction and try it again. And while we didn't change anything that's going to make that instruction do anything different, and we're going back to that instruction and not the one after because we didn't finish it, we still have to do it. We didn't change anything, it's not going to work the second time. And we still have a handler set up for the segmentation fault signal. So we do this process again. There's a hardware exception saying, oh, that memory still isn't valid. The OS says, oh, there's a handler. Let me run that handler. The handler runs. It prints out a message. It returns. The OS says, OK, now we need to restore the state from before the handler ran. So we'll go back to that same instruction, try it again. And we just keep doing this forever. So this is just a funny way of writing an infinite loop. Questions about our segmentation fault handler example? So you might ask, like, if this is how this works, why are we allowed to handle this? Like, why is this functionality that someone spent time implementing? And the answer is that we can actually write useful handlers. They just don't look like this. And there's kind of two different things we can do. The most common thing is that we can write a handler that doesn't like try to go back to the normal program, but like tries to print out a better error message than the one you'd usually get, or tries to like save the state of the program so we can recover from the crash maybe without losing everything. There are things we can do, but they aren't going to be just go back to the program as if nothing happened. That's not going to solve our problem. And that's probably the most common reason you'll see real programs handle the segmentation fault signals. They'll have some code that like tries to do something that's not as bad as the normal crash, but probably still isn't great. Another thing we can potentially do is that if we somehow changed what memory we had allocated for a process, then return back, maybe the access would work the second time. So if we had some way of allocating that memory address, then we can make the segmentation fault handler actually fix the problem and go back and run the program normally. I would say this is uncommon, but it's not unheard of for programs to do this. It's a very, very non-portable to do, but I have heard of programs doing it, like some JavaScript implementations I've heard of being implemented with this kind of thing. So questions about our segmentation fault handler. Okay, so we've looked at sort of the basics of using signals, and we've kind of seen one function for handling signals, which is sigaction, the one that registers a signal handler. There's actually a whole bunch of others. I'm going to talk about arguably the most important, maybe not. So there's a function, a system call called kill, to send a signal to a particular process. And kind of the history here is that, the original use case for this was that it would just terminate a process. It was only later on that they realized, we should have the processes do things when they would be terminated instead, and this evolved into just a send signal. But all this does is send a signal. That signal's action need not be anything related to terminating the process, just because of the historical context that it used to be the case that the process would essentially always terminate after you did this. It's called kill. And when we call kill, we need to identify which process should receive the signal. And there's going to be an integer process ID for that. If you want to know what your program's process ID is, there's a library call called getPID, which will tell you. So then, something you might want to do is you want to wait for a signal to happen. And there's a system library call to do that called pause that will just put the current thread to sleep until a signal is received and a signal handler runs. We're also going to talk about maybe that we don't want to handle signals all the time. We'll have a very good reason why it's actually not good for us that signal handlers run just whenever. That's actually very inconvenient, and we'll give a very specific example of why that can be very inconvenient. So to let us control exactly when signal handlers run, there's this functionality where we can do what is called blocking signals. When a signal is blocked, it still gets received, but it's left as pending until it's unblocked. So the signal isn't ignored, it's just left pending until it's unblocked. It's just waiting for us to unblock it. So the OS still tracks that signal, doesn't go away unless we do something to make it go away, but it doesn't get handled while it's blocked. So this lets us sort of not have signals happen, signal handlers run for a little bit of time, and we'll find out that that's like a really actually pretty useful piece of functionality, because it turns out writing signal handlers that aren't buggy is shockingly hard without something like that. So let's first talk about our kill command. Kill. So there's the kill function, and you might be familiar with the kill command line program, which is a good introduction to that because it basically just calls the kill function, just a wrapper for it. So if you wanted to try to get program 1234 to terminate, you might run the command kill space 1234, where 1234 is a process ID that you look up somehow. And this sends the signal sigterm, term for terminate, to process 1234. Since sigterm isn't sigkill, if you look at my list of signals here, sigkill is the special one that can't be handled, sigterm can. So the process could have a handler for that, but if it doesn't, the default for sigterminate is just terminate the process without doing anything else, just get rid of it. We can also send specific signals to programs, and with the kill command, one way we can do that is by passing minus and the name of the signal. So for sig user one, the name we'll pass is user one. And this turns into just a kill call with a different signal identifier. Okay, questions about our kill function? Yes. Question, if we send sigterm, can the program handle it? Yes. So the signals that we can't handle are kill and stop. So if you do kill minus kill, 1234, then the program cannot handle that because sigkill is special. You might, when you read what other people write, some people have memorized the number that sigkill corresponds to and will write kill minus 9. That's the same thing. Like, I'm not going to just write the number, but a lot of people have memorized that number because that's the terminate this program, really, I don't care command. And people who've used Unix-like system for a while have had to type that a lot. And I guess it used to be the case that minus capital kill wasn't supported back in probably the 90s, 80s. You have to use the number, but that's not the case anymore. But yes, so there, you can also send the signals that can't be handled, but most of the signals you'd send can be. Now, I mentioned signal blocking. So we can temporarily pause signals from being handled. And that might give you the impression, if we aren't blocking signals, that means when I call kill, right away the handler runs. And that's not quite true. So kill you know, it sends the signal to the process, but it's not guaranteed the handler, if there is one to handle it, runs right away, even if the process isn't blocking the signal or anything. And a common reason for this is that if the process is on another core, it's actually pretty annoying for the OS to make sure right away code on that other core runs the handler, so typically it won't. Instead, typically it will just run it at some point soon. So you might have a situation where you call kill, kill returns, and the handler hasn't run, even though it's going to. You know, typically like on the order of microseconds, but it's going to be enough that like the output won't be in the order you expect, for example. I note there's a special case that if you send a signal to your own process, this can't happen. But if you're sending to another process, you can have this kind of desync. It could also be the case, you know, that the OS manages to act on the signal earlier. It's just, you know, it's just kind of random. But the OS has the flexibility of waiting a little bit. There's no guarantee the signal has actually been acted on when kill returns, just that the OS has recorded it and it's going to be handled in some way. So questions about this sort of deferred kill idea? So I'll say there's a special case where if we have a, if PIDA kills A, then that's going to run the kernel and it's going to immediately run the signal handler and then return from kill. So there's a special case that if you're killing your own process ID, it does happen right away. In fact, before kill even returns, but if you're killing other programs, you're just telling the OS, do this soon. And that may not be instantaneous. Questions? Okay, so mind here, I have two programs, and let's say we've somehow magically arranged that the first program runs at PID 1000, the second one runs at PID 2000, and we start them at the exact same time. What output should I get? I'll give you some minutes. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what you think the output should be. And in here, this call to write prints out X to the terminal. And this call to write prints out Y to the terminal. And the underscore exit function terminates the program with as if you return 0 from me, in the case of passing 0 in. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, that the output will be X, Y? Okay, how about B, just X? Okay, how about C, just Y? How about D, Y, X? Okay, how about E, X, or X, Y? Depends on some timing, okay? How about F, there will be a crash? How about G, there's not gonna be no output? Okay, and how about H, something else is gonna happen? And how about no clue? You're no clues, okay. So we kind of have this split where I think A is the most common answer followed by B and E. And let's go through the argument for A, which because that is what the most common answer is, because it's probably the most straightforward way of kind of tracing what goes on here. And that's going to be that we run this kill. We're telling PID 1000, this is PID 1000. We look for the sick user one handler. Well, we registered one here. We look, it's going to be handle user one. So we're going to go up to here. We're going to write 1000, great. Then we're going to kill PID 2000. We look at here, oh, we registered a handler for user one. So that means that this is going to run at some point, and then PID 1000 exits, and eventually PID 2000 outputs Y, so we get our XY. So that's the interpretation that gives us XY as a possible output. So there's an issue here, which is that in order for my call to, I see what I did. In order for my call to kill to set call to kill here to actually run that signal handler, I have to be after the signal handler was registered, but before PID 2000 exits. And that's actually a very small time window. That's, you know, that's here, basically, this little bit of time window. So it needs to be before the return from main completely finishes and cleans up the program, and after the SIG action actually registers the handler. So that's actually a very tiny time window. And unless these programs are somehow very well synced, that actually probably won't happen. So instead, we're going to be trying to kill a program that doesn't exist. So usually we'll get X, but sometimes we'll get very lucky and get XY. So I think the kind of best answer is E. And this is, I would say, is a very subtle issue because, well, you know, because it depends on the timing exactly. And we usually don't think of kind of the code that registers the signal handler as taking time, but it does. So we might not call kill fast enough, depending on how fast they run relative to each other. And we kind of usually gloss over the fact that after SIG action, something is going to happen if there's nothing to do. And well, that something in this case is that we drop out of main, the program doesn't keep going, it exits. So questions on how I got this answer here, my X or XY. So let's do a revised version. So here I've added two things. So one thing is I've stopped PID 2000 from just exiting. I now have an infinite loop that calls the pause function to wait for a single handler to run. And in PID 1000, I call this sleep function, which to ask request that the OS have the process stop doing anything for, in this case, 1 second. Give you a minute to, or what you think the answer is now. Did it change? Who'd like some more time? Not seeing anyone. So who thinks our answer is now A? It's definitely X, Y. Okay? Who thinks it's B? It's definitely X. Thinks it's C? It's just Y. D? E? It still depends on timing. F? There's going to be a crash. G? No output. And H? Something else is going to happen. U for something else. And no clue. Okay, so I think our majority answer is A, and I will say yes, kinda. So what's the kinda? We're making an assumption here, a pretty safe assumption, but an assumption we shouldn't make nonetheless, that this code here will take 1 second, and there's no real guarantee of that. You know, maybe the system's really overloaded because I'm like compiling 5,000 things. Oops. So if we actually wanted to do this, we probably want a more robust way of making sure the signal handler is registered than just waiting 1 second and hoping that works out. If that's in fact true, we're fine. If that's not true, then we're going to end up, we might end up sending the signal too early, in which case there's no handler registered, and actually the default action is to terminate the program. So the program won't even get to the end. And if you're in a shell, it'll print out user-defined signal one. Just like when you get a seg fault, it prints out segmentation fault. But most of the time, yes, we'd expect to get A. If we wanted to make that all the time, we need to have some way of communicating between these two programs that yes, the signal handler is really registered before we actually move on in PID 1000. Questions? Yes, yeah.
It's the same assumption because both process IDs like are running the same code. Is that why? Because they're starting at the same time.
Quick question, it's a safe assumption? It is not a safe assumption.
Oh, it's not.
It's not. It is very likely, extremely likely. The reason it's extremely likely is that typically, this code here takes like a millisecond. So like over the normal time for it, we have a margin of like 1,000. But it's definitely not actually safe. There will be cases in which it fails. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the question, if we wanted to communicate the handler setup, could we do it by sort of using sending a signal? No, because we have the problem in the opposite direction of do we know the handler setup? So we need some other thing going on. So one example might be whoever runs PID 1000, or whoever runs PID 1000 maybe only starts it after PID 2000 prints out a message. And that in fact, we're gonna have a lab next week using signals, and that's the strategy you're gonna use to make sure you don't run into this problem. So that you're not gonna move on, and the second program is gonna wait for input, and you won't type in that input until after the other program has things set up. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so signal handlers seem very useful, but they are in fact extremely tricky to use safely, and we're gonna talk about sort of why I say they're unsafe. And that's also gonna reveal why was I using these weird functions? Like, why am I not just calling printf? It's also gonna explain that. So let's go through an example here. So let's say I make a single handler for SIGINT, and rather than using write, like some of the examples I showed you before, I use printf, like the normal thing. Normal people programming C do when they want to output, use printf or puts, function like that. And let's say we press Control C in the middle of this call to malloc here. Okay, that should work still. We just print out the message, move on back to this call to malloc. Yeah, so that seems fine. But malloc, is actually library code. So it turns out the way malloc is typically implemented is that it gets big chunks of memory from the OS, and it kind of subdivides them. And kind of one way we could do this is we can get our big chunk of memory, and we can have a pointer in it, which I've called here next to return. And when you request, say, 1,024 bytes, what we'll do is we will segment off this as your, 1,024 bytes, and then advance next to return to after that. And we'll just keep doing that as we allocate more and more until we have to get another big chunk of memory from the OS. So this is a typical way malloc could work. And let's say we get really lucky or really unlucky, and our signal, we press Control C exactly here. That's where our program stops. So just after we figured out the current value of next return, but before we incremented it. Why is this going to be a problem? Well, it's going to be a problem because printf, it might need to allocate some memory. It's probably going to do it with malloc. It's allowed to do that. So we're going to call malloc in the middle of malloc. And it turns out that malloc isn't written to handle that. So somewhere in printf, they're allocating a buffer to do some work. Okay. So what does this look like? Well, we're running foo. Foo calls malloc. Malloc is retrieving the value to return. So we have our big region of memory. We have our to return, our next to return. And we make a copy of that, and that is going to be put into to return for foo. Then printf calls malloc, and its copy of malloc has its own to return. And whoa, next to return didn't change. So it gets the same pointer. And then printf is going to do this operation of advancing this pointer up here. We've just allocated a bunch of stuff. And printf is going to use this chunk of memory here. Great. And eventually printf returns, and we go back, exit our signal handler, and go back to foo. Foo's implementation of malloc is going to continue, and it's going to return this pointer and advance next to return. So we're going to add a bit more to it. But the region that I'll probably emphasize, advance next to return, so like maybe here. And foo is going to use this memory, which is the same memory printf's using. This might be problematic at some point, that printf's using this memory and foo is using this memory, and they both think they have it to themselves. And at some point, they might notice that, why is my memory changing when I print things? Huh, that's weird. And this would be why. Also, we kind of lost track of a bunch of memory entirely. And we might have other things happening, like maybe printf frees this memory. And so now foo is accessing deallocated memory. And like, I kind of have a better, a more systematic illustration of kind of what our calls look like here, right? We have our call to foo, it calls malloc, malloc, you know, stores that value to return before incrementing next to return, but then sigint happens, it calls printf, printf mallocs again, it gets another copy of next to return, increments the pointer, returns, gets another copy, and now we have p points to p and buff, you know, are the same thing. And probably this is not going to work out well, and more concerningly, the way this bug would manifest in your program is going to be super non-intuitive. It's going to be really hard to figure out, why did my program suddenly crash? Because, you know, it's probably not going to happen in the call to printf. It's probably going to happen way later when you try to use buff in foo, or when you try to use printf later on, because printf stashed the buffer somewhere. So, let's say, what can we do about this? This seems really bad. You know, surely, you know, there's some solution which is gonna let us call printf in our signal handlers. And we'll talk about that, but the real guarantees are very poor. So POSIX, which is the standard Linux follows, basically says that there's a list of async signal safe functions. These are functions which won't have this problem I illustrated to you. They have deliberately not put malloc, printf, and a whole bunch of functions you would think would be nice to use on that list. And the reason why is probably because it's a lot of work to make this and it has a performance penalty to make it async signal safe, so they just don't bother. There are functions that are on that list, and among those functions is write and underscore xset, and I guess I can write down and, you know, kill, and that's why the signal handlers I showed you earlier used those specific functions instead of the more logical ones. But for example, printf, not on the list. So printf implementations aren't required to be written in a way that avoids this issue. Same with malloc. And even the normal xset function isn't, because it calls add xset functions. Underscore xset doesn't do that. So questions about this idea of async signal safety? Yeah. So basically, all the functions that are on this list that POSIX made are required to be written so they don't have that type of bug I told you about. And there's, we'll talk about kind of one strategy you could use to do that, that you can also use to like avoid worrying about this problem in your programs that use signals. But, you know, they have to do something to prevent the problem. But most functions don't have that requirement just because it's gonna, they don't want to slow down printf for this rare scenario. It's basically what they decided. So we're gonna talk about alternatives to using signal handlers. And my advice would be, if you're writing a real program, just don't use signal handlers if you can get away with it. Sometimes you can't, but for the most part, just don't use signal handlers is my advice. Obviously, a lot of people use signal handlers, and you can do it safely, but I think it's easier not to. But how can we handle signals without using signal handlers? And that blocking operation is really going to help us out. So instead of having our signal handler run whenever and possibly run in the middle of something that's mallocing, we can block the signal and only unblock it when we know we're not running any unsafe functions. And the library calls sigprocmask or pthreadsigmask are both ways of unblocking and blocking signals. And when a signal is blocked, it doesn't get ignored. It just is not handled until it's unblocked. But it is left as pending the OS tracks that it's pending. So we can have this kind of timeline where we block a signal, and that signal is recorded as blocked. And if we receive that signal, the OS remembers, OK, you received it. And it marks that the signal is both blocked and pending. And later on, if you unblock the signal handler will run right away because the signal was pending. Okay, so questions about blocking signals? Yeah?
If the program exits while the signal is still pending, does the signal just go away or is it still somehow?
Question, if the program exits while the signal is still pending, does it just go away? Yes. Other questions? Yeah? Are you able to make sigkill be blocked? No. Sigkill and stop, just like you can't set a handler for them, you can mark them as blocked, but it won't do anything. Other questions? Okay. And so this lets us run signal handlers at specific times, but that's still not super convenient. So there's some functions to help us out that we can use in combination with blocking. And there's kind of two flavors of them. So there's some functions that are unblock and do some other stuff. So one example is there's a function called sigsuspend, which unblocks a signal and immediately waits for it to be handled and returns once it's handled. And it does this in a way where you don't have to worry about, you know, unblocking it, it's handled, and then you start waiting. It does it in a way that, you know, guarantees that if it's handled, it will return. If it's not handled, it will wait indefinitely. Also, there's a function called pselect, which you can use if you want to do the operation of wait for some I/O, say from the network, like wait for information on the network, or for a signal at the same time. Pselect is a function you can effectively use to do wait for those two things at once. Yeah. What's the difference between sigsuspend and pause? Sigsuspend changes the signal mask, so it unblocks the signal as it pauses. So basically, sigsuspend is pause and change the signal mask at the same time with nothing, no time in between, so you don't have to worry about missing something. That answer your question? Another way we can handle these things is that there's an API for expecting pending signals. So rather than having any signal handlers at all, we can instead use functions like sigwait, which is going to wait for a signal to become pending and remove it from the list of pending signals. So the handler never runs, we never unblock the signal, sigwait just tells us the signal was there and marks it as not pending anymore. So instead of having any signal handlers, we just block the signal. We call sigwait to check if it was received, and if so, sigwait tells us it was, and we do something about it ourselves without the OS running a handler for us. And so we have this timeline here. We block a signal, it gets received. Then we can call sigwait later while it's pending, and sigwait will say, oh, it's pending. Let's unpend it, return, say, got that signal, and it's going to remain blocked. So if we call sigwait again, we can receive it happens another time. But because sigwait makes it become no longer pending, you know, we don't need a handler at all. You know, the signal just never gets delivered. Sigwait just handles it without letting it actually run any handlers. And as an example of what calling sigwait would look like, so here I have code where I first block a signal and then wait for it with sigwait. So what this does is I set up a sigset t, and this represents a list of signals. So Here, I'm only dealing with one signal, sig int, but we can actually deal with a whole bunch of signals at once. So I initialize this data structure with these utility functions, sig empty set and sig add set, to basically be what in, you know, maybe a better programming language, this might be written, you know, like this, but unfortunately, C is not so flexible to let us do that. So we have to have these functions for manipulating our data structure that's a set of items. And once we do that, we pass that list to the sig proc mass function and say, this list of signals, I want to block all of them. So modify my process's set of block signals to include that list. And the null argument is where sigprocmass would tell us about what is the old set of block signals before this. We don't care, so I just put null. Then in this case, I say print waiting for sigint. And then I call sigwait. And to sigwait, I pass the list of signals I want to wait for, and a place to put, you know, where to put which signal happened. In this case, there's only one possibility, but if I added other things to that set, I could use sigwait to wait for multiple signals at the same time, and I'd have to use num to tell which one actually caused sigwait to finish. And sigwait's return value tells me if it failed or not. Probably it wouldn't. And then I can check that, oh, I in fact got sigint. And this waits for sigint without actually using any signal handlers. And the way this will work, you know, so we kind of have two scenarios, right? Our program runs, we block the signal, and then, you know, maybe I start sigwait starts, and then I have the control C, and then sigwait returns. So that would be the most common case for how this program would work, is that the signal would be blocked, and immediately when it becomes pending, sigwait says, oh, there it is, and returns. Another thing which could happen is I could run this program, I could block the signal, and then I could type control C, and maybe sigwait happens after that. And that would be fine, and sigwait would return right away. Because what would happen is here, the signal would be blocked, and here, if I press control C before sigwait started, the signal would be blocked and pending. And then afterwards, the signal would just be blocked. So sigwait, it will wait if it's not pending already. If it is pending, it will just say, oh, it's already happened, here you go. Questions about sigwait? Okay. So that's where we're going to finish up talking about signals. So my personal advice is always try to do sigwait, sigsuspend, those sorts of things, rather than signal handlers. But obviously that doesn't always work out. And well, some people have argued that signal handlers, even with the signal safety issues, are easier to think about. But I want to advise you that, you know, maybe in practice, using a signal handler for something, it's very tricky. So we're gonna move on to our next topic, and this is gonna kind of go back to one of the things we kind of glossed over, which is that, oh, we have these PIDs. Where do those come from? And we're gonna talk basically about how do we manage processes, and we're gonna look at sort of the specific example of the POSIX API, the API that Unix-like systems, including Linux and kind of OS X, all use. And we mentioned actually one of these functions. We mentioned getPID. Processes have an ID, that's a number. GetPID is the library function, usually also a system call to retrieve that. But we also want to do other things with processes. You know, we want to kill them. Well, we mentioned that part, which also is signaling them. We want to like create them and wait for them. So we're going to talk about those operations. And something here that's going to seem really weird and is maybe a bad design decision by the Unix people, but it's what they did, is that creating processes and running a particular program are separate operations. So making a new process is a different thing than running a different program in a process. So you might say, how does this work? How can these be separate? So let's talk about the process creation library call, which is fork. And I will say that fork is one of the most confusing functions in the Unix standard library. And here is the prototype of fork. It takes no arguments. It is still one of the most confusing functions in the library. So fork makes a new process. And you might say, what do we put in that new process? And the answer fork has is we just copy everything in the current one. So it makes an exact full copy of the current process. And that means we're going to copy all of the memory, all of the registers, all of the open files, all of the signal handlers. Everything is going to be the same in the new process, except the new process needs a new ID. And also, it probably would be inconvenient if we return the same thing in the new process. And I might say, wait, in the new process? Okay, so we're copying the process. Part of what we're copying is, where are we in our execution? And where are we? We're in the middle of fork. So the new process is going to be in the middle of fork. So when that new process starts running, what is it going to do? It's going to return from fork. When the old process keeps running, what is it going to do? It's going to return from fork. So this function returns twice. Returns once in our new copy and once in the old copy. And it would be kind of hard to tell these two copies apart in our code without some extra signal. So to help us out with that, the return value is deliberately different in the copy versus the original. So we're going to call the original the parent, so that's the original process, and in that process, fork is going to return the new PID it created, and we're going to call the new process the copy, the child process, and in that process, it's going to return zero. So questions about this concept of we're copying our program and why we have end up returning two times, once in the original, once in the copy. Okay, so let's look kind of pictorially at this. So we have our parent process about to call fork, and we have kind of our info that the OS is somehow tracking for the process. So we have like all the register values it has. We have its address space mapping. So this is the memory mapping, which we'll learn is stored in something called page tables. And it has a set of page tables that point to all the memory the program can access. We also have a bunch of open files and some other information. So when you call fork, we're going to copy all of this info. And it's going to be a deep copy. So copying that structure isn't enough. We're also going to copy all of the memory that it points to. And adjust the memory map to point out the new copies of that memory. So we'll have new values for all the registers. Well, they start the same as the old ones, but new copies of all those values. new copies of all our open files, new copies of all the contents of memory. And if you're looking at this, you might say, wait, you wrote this without copy on write. What's that about? So you might observe, this seems really slow. Why are we copying absolutely everything? Isn't that not always a good idea? And the answer is yes. And one of the things we're gonna do about that is we're gonna have an optimization called copy on write that we're not yet prepared to explain how it works, but we'll talk about it later in the semester once we talk about how page tables work, because they're gonna be a big part of making that possible. But without that optimization, we actually literally copy everything. And I said we distinguish the two copies. So it's really inconvenient if we're actually returning from fork and you can't like change what you do depending on what process you're in. So to help you out with that, we will deliberately return different things in the original versus the copy. So in this example, REX is where we put our return value. So we'll put the child process ID, the new one, and the parent's return address, return value, sorry, and in the child process, we'll put 0 there, just to let you know it's not the new, it is the new process, it's not the old one. Okay, so questions? Fork here, yes.
So fork is like copying the entire address space of the old one and like storing it as a separate entry.
So question, fork is copying the entire address space of the old one and storing it in a separate places? Yep. In addition to copying all the registers and other stuff. Yeah, and we'll talk later about a way of like avoiding really copying everything, but it's gonna look like we copy everything, even with that optimization. It's gonna behave the exact same way. Yeah?
So is this the only way to start another process?
This question, is this the only way to start another process? So in kind of original Unix, the answer was yes. In kind of modern OSs, there are some other ways. We're not gonna talk much about them. But I can talk about it sort of other times if you want. Yeah?
So then once you make the new process, will the new processes just continue their code from that line?
Question, once I make the new process, will the two processes continue their code from that line? Yep, they'll continue starting with returning from fork. And we have an example here, so we can do that. So here's an example, some code that uses fork. And you can see I sort of get my PID a bunch of times because I know it's going to change because our new process is going to have a new PID. And you can see I output my parent's PID here. And then I call fork, and I have this pattern here where I check the return value of fork. And pretty much any time you call fork, you're probably gonna do this. So I check the return value of fork. If my PID is greater than 0, I know that tells me it's the parent process, and the PID I have is the child's process's PID. And in this example, I print out, you know, get PID now and the child process. If the PID is 0, I know that's not the real PID of another program. That's just a signal to tell me you're in the child process. And I print out that. And I have this else case because fork can fail. Most common reason why would be out of memory. Run out of memory, you know, that copy needs space. If you don't have it, it's going to fail. So I'm going to kind of represent what goes on here is that we're running one program. It's going to print out the parent PID and whatever that process ID is. Then we'll call fork, and we'll end up having two things kind of running side by side, and they might not stay in sync. But in this example, I'm saying, let's say the parent happens to be the first thing to print out after the call to fork. Could be the other way around. And our PIDs are 100 for the parent, and the child gets PID 432, this is the output we get. We have this code run before the call to fork, print out parent PID colon 100. Then our call to fork happens, and our printout of the parent printing out the child's PID is running at the same time as our child printing out its PID. And in this example, I just assume that the parent was a little bit faster. Could have been the other way around, in which case the lines would be swapped in order. Any questions? This example. People look confused. Yeah.
So like, if form is returning twice, is it like, I don't know if this exists to you, but is it kind of like async in the sense that it like waits for the second return before you like move to the conditional?
Question, is it asynchronous in the sense it waits for the second return? No. It returns twice, and basically both if statements, the one that runs on the parent and the one that runs, both copies of the if statement run at the same time. And by at the same time, I mean actually sort of whoever's faster, right? They're kind of racing each other. There's nothing that constrains them to actually be in sync in any way. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is where we'll finish up, and we'll talk more about fork and also the other process manipulation library functions.